I have only one magic trick that I can pull off successfully: telling stories from history. Almost every time I do, a listener will make some connection, and then be amazed, regardless of the topic, of how well the present moment is discussed in my exploration of the past. It does seem like magic. How could a tale from, say, 1663 speak so specifically to an issue we struggle with now? Well, I'm not constrained by any magician's code, so I'll tell you the secret to the trick. Every discussion of history will resonate with today, because history is human. That's the phrase David McCullough used when I interviewed him years ago, and I've stolen it. History is human. We are not nearly so far advanced from the people of the past. They loved and longed and struggled and strove just like we do. The magic trick is that I'm not telling stories about history, I'm telling stories about humans. Today we're presenting an episode from the podcast The Road to Now, from hosts Dr. Benjamin Sawyer and Bob Crawford. Ben's a friend of mine. We shared beers and barbecue a few months ago at his hometown of Nashville. Ben's also a senior instructor of history at Middle Tennessee State University and a stand-up comedian. Meanwhile, Bob is best known as the bassist for the Grammy-nominated band The Avett Brothers, which is the very first band my now wife and I ever talked about back in our dating days. But their guest needs no introduction. Ken Burns is one of the most prominent popular historians alive today. In their discussion, Ken reveals that he, too, knows the magic trick. He's never had to ask himself, why now, or what's the connection to the present when working on a new documentary, because he knows the answer is the connection between the present moment and history is that history is human. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. And be sure to search for and follow The Road to Now wherever you're listening. We've put some links in the show notes, too.
Ken Burns, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you so much for having me. I love that title. I think that's exactly right.
Thank you so much. Watching Ernest Hemingway, the documentary coming out here in early April on everyone's local PBS station, it is mentioned in the film by someone that Ernest Hemingway created a myth of himself.
Yes.
First of all, why Ernest Hemingway? Why now?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been working on it for 6 years, so we don't ever plan with a sense of the moment that it comes out. But I can tell you that, you know, people like to say history repeats itself. We're condemned to repeat what we don't remember. It's just not true. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And every time we do a film, we might take 10 and a half years as the Vietnam stuff. We lift up and it's like talking about the present. And we never, while we're making it, it would be a dereliction of duty is to focus or trust on that kind of thing. And so, you know, I made a film that came out in the fall of 17. So you can imagine what was going on as I was promoting it all through the early years of 17. And I said, this is a film. What if I told you I'd been working for over a decade on a film about mass demonstrations taking place all across the country against the current administration, about a White House in disarray, obsessed with leaks, about a president certain the media was lying about him, about huge, big document drops of stolen classified information into the public sphere that destabilized the political equation, about asymmetrical warfare that confounded the mighty might of the U.S. military, about accusations that a political party reached out to a foreign government at the time of a national election to affect that election. You'd say, you've been talking about what's been going on for the last, 2 years. And in fact, all of those things were true when I began this project on the Vietnam War at the end of 2006 and remained true when we finished the film, locked the picture, at the end of 2015, a month before the Iowa caucuses, out of which Donald Trump was not supposed to emerge. I can take any film that I've made and give you that kind of what if I told you thing. I'm not going to do that. So we've been drawn to Ernest Hemingway. He's arguably, we made a film a few decades ago on Mark Twain, who is arguably the greatest American writer of the 19th century. Hemingway is considered by many the greatest. But in each one, you get a chance to go in and understand what makes a human being tick. You get a chance to evaluate in a critical way their art and its transcendent qualities. You get to understand the way in which all of us make myths about ourselves. Look, the fish gets bigger the farther away from the lake you get. You know, you may have the guy that got away is this big, but by the time you get home, it's this big. And, you know, that's human nature, right? And so when you have a large outsized personality, you magnify this very human thing. It's Shakespearean. And that's why Shakespeare is Shakespeare, because he's taking these larger than life people and helps to play out very human and recognizable things. All of us can recognize ourselves in an Ernest Hemingway. We're not as great writers as him. We're not as bad a husband or a father, perhaps. We're not as complicated in that regard, but we have all of these ingredients. And so we use these mythologically great figures to parse these questions of fact. And my job is to not sort of shun all the mythology, all the ways in which we are blind, but to try to create a framework in which the facts govern the story and you permit the audience the complication of understanding, as they know in their own life, that nothing's black and white. Everything's a shade of gray. If you think it's black and white, you can't be married. If you think it's black and white, you can't be a parent. You can't even be a pet owner, right? You just, things aren't that way. And yet we live in a computer world in which it's all ones and zeros, and we live in a media culture in which it's all good or bad, red state or blue state. And nobody selects for complication, for undertow, for the kinds of things that are the stuff of life, which is what we try to do in our history. So Hemingway is endlessly fascinating for the failures, and he's endlessly fascinating for the way the output of his day job, writing, is transcendent and will always be transcendent. And then it turns out that all that masculine posturing hid an incredibly fluid sexuality that nobody could have related to in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, but is totally relatable now, that he wrote stories as if he was a woman and put himself into the character of the woman, that the novelist Edna O'Brien says, this is unbelievable, this short story or this novel, these things, this is impossible for this guy. And yet it's true. And then we learn more about concussions that he had that may have promoted the CTE that added to alcoholism and drug abuses and a history of mental illness in the family and suicides in the family, all of which create the soup where you cannot say, oh, I know, this is what made him pull the trigger. You don't do that. You just say, it's like looking at a hurricane, right? You just marvel at the size of it. And that's our obligation, you know, is it's not so much that you're not making judgment. That's ridiculous, right? You tell your kids, do not play in traffic. What part of that don't you understand? We can be absolute. We can be black and white. But for the most part, we need to be much more tolerant. Keats wrote a letter to someone about William Shakespeare. And he said that Shakespeare had negative capability. That's the ability to hold in tension a person's strengths and their weaknesses. The moralist in us wants us to decide good or bad right away. But if you keep that in tension, then you are serving humanity and serving art and serving human understanding and serving human communication. And so, you know, in our own poor way, we've tried to sort of practice that kind of negative capability. From the very first films that we were working on, that was hugely important to us. And so it's there, I think you'll see in the Ernest Hemingway that's coming up in April on PBS, 5th, 6th, 7th. And you'll see it in the next film on Muhammad Ali, in the next film on Benjamin Franklin, on the next film on the U.S. and the Holocaust, the next film on LBJ and the Great Society, the next film on the history of the buffalo, the next one on Leonardo da Vinci, the next one on the American Revolution, and the next one on the history of the lead up to Reconstruction, Reconstruction's collapse, and then African-American life in the decades after Reconstruction. Those are the ones we're all working on. They're all underway, and they're all kind of percolating in this brain right here. But, you know, we can't wait to share them with you. And they all share that same willingness to tolerate contradiction.
You mentioned Edna O'Brien, and when you were talking about Hemingway, I texted Bob late last night and said that Edna O'Brien is the Shelby Foote of the Hemingway documentary.
She's our secret weapon. She's unbelievable. Lynn Novick, my co-director, did the interview. It is so great. You know, she came in armed. You know, she said, I want to read this. And at that point, you know, a lot of my colleagues will go and say, look, can you get us from paragraph 2 to paragraph 3 on page 4 of episode 3? You know, we never do that. We just go and we read. And if you see a talking head in our film, it's a kind of happy accident of us trying to move stuff around and trial and error. So we're not trying to, you know, fit something into a particular moment. So you go and she wants to read about Up in Michigan, a short story that we're only vaguely familiar with. Yeah. And she wants to read the opening to A Farewell to Arms, which we are familiar with. And we're very happy to do this. And the cameraman, thank God, decides to follow her conducting of the words, you know, and then up to her. And yeah, she's the, I wouldn't even call it the Shelby Foote. She's the Edna O'Brien of the Hemingway film. You know?
She had there's two things. There's a moment in the third episode of the series where I had two epiphanies, and one was really beginning to understand The Old Man and the Sea, which I read like 20 years ago.
Yes.
I got it. The second one was that Edna O'Brien is a masterpiece, because after realizing what the book was about, finding meaning in it, you cut to her and she says, schoolboy writing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but this is hugely important. If you'll notice, Llosa, Mario Vargas Llosa, you know, Nobel laureate in literature, loves Old Man and the Sea. And he tells you how to read it both as a kid, you know, when it's assigned in high school, and how to read it now, Ben, as an adult, and what it means and how the meaning migrates as you yourself undergo your life's journey, and that it's this epitome of a concise existential thing. And meanwhile, back in For Whom the Bell Tolls, he just finds it cloying, ridiculous, lovemaking. Did the earth move? He's cracking up in Spanish and, you know, we're trying to follow him along. Whereas other commentators are saying this is, like John McCain, this is the most serious novel. And Edna is saying stuff about A Farewell to Arms, where she said, this could have been written by a woman. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you take that as an insult, but I consider it a compliment. I mean, he gets the boy stuff right, she says, about A Farewell to Arms, but what do you remember? A woman dying in childbirth. I mean, this is great. And then you want to let her say, you know, you don't have to like every single piece of Hemingway. We're telling our audience, we're liberating our audience. If Edna doesn't like it, doesn't mean you have to not like it, but there it is. You begin to say that art is taste, and art falls on people in different ways. But what's so interesting to me in that third episode, after all the rough treatment of wives, particularly his last wife, Mary, gets the worst of it. She's reading The Old Man and the Sea. And she basically says, you know, as he's turning it out and he's leaning over her, and she said, you know, I forgive you for all the terrible things you said to me. And then that shows you that there is just this price we pay for being in the presence of a great artist. Not always. Not everyone is a jerk. Hemingway is difficult, and a lot of it is born of these deep-seated fears and curiosities about the thing that all of us spend most of our lives avoiding, is that none of us get out of here alive. And he's willing to write to that and to try to live to that, but it's hell for the people around him.
Hemingway believed that every story, if you follow it long enough, ends in death.
Yeah, and it's true. It's the story of us.
Fascinated by brutality. Talk for a minute about his fascination with bullfighting and his desire and his need to write about it.
Well, it's interesting because he recognized back then that he was going to have to sell Americans on something that they didn't share with their European ancestors, or most of us have European ancestors, and that this was a kind of Western but European mythology sport, that it was a gigantic tragedy, and that Americans would see it as kind of brutality. And we as filmmakers inherited that problem. The mythology is that the bull has to die. And how that happens, which is like us, all of us have to die. The art comes from the way in which this inevitability is manipulated by the toreador and all the others connected with this ritual. But the bull has to die. And so for many of us, there's a kind of gut feeling of repulsion at why we need to do this, particularly in the United States, coming as we do. The same applies to a lesser extent to his fascination with hunting, big game hunting in Africa, hunting all the time, less so in fishing because we're separated from that. But all of these raise real questions. And at the heart of bullfighting is this epic human dynamic of bullfighting, in which, you know, as one of the commentators says, the bull is a text which you read. And so each one of these is individual. And what Hemingway was trying to do is he got it. He wasn't sure that anyone else would get it. And he tried his best, one of the great explainers of things. I mean, I remember growing up in Ann Arbor, some old hippie said to me in the late 60s, I learned how to roll a cigarette from Ernest Hemingway. We interviewed a woman from then North Vietnam who, as a teenage girl, went down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to repair it, the damage done by American bombings. An incredibly risky thing. And she took along For Whom the Bell Tolls and said she survived because she had Hemingway telling her how to survive within a war context. I mean, if that doesn't sort of prove his worth now, despite all of the disqualifying negative things, I don't know what does. And then, of course, it's irresistible. The rubbernecking for the rest of us at this life, falling apart but also coming together and falling apart is just, it's irresistible story. You know, and that's why I think maybe getting back, Ben, to your idea of a person who didn't have ups and downs, but was the classic antagonist, I think can still make a pretty good story eventually.
The thing that gets me, and I think that's beautiful about Hemingway, and you capture this, is that Hemingway knew, he really knew that he was flawed. The exchange he has with one of his sons, where he blames the son for his mother's death, and then the response is the letter that his son writes him is so, I mean, just no restraints. And Hemingway writes back.
In our opening, he said, I want to be great and I want to be good, and I don't know if I can be either. And that's it. That's all of our wish, you know, or maybe not all of our wishes. Not everybody wants to be great or to, I mean, the penalty we learn of the greatness, both the greatness that came to him organically from the quality of the writing and the way in which that greatness was expanded by the mythology that grew up around him, that he helped himself create, the lies. He's not solely responsible. Everybody was more than willing to go along with it. And how that then made it harder for him to do the thing that had made him famous in the first place. These are just conundrums. I remember when we were making Jazz and I interviewed Wynton Marsalis, we were talking about something that will take us off on a tangent of a half an hour if I bring up what the subject was. But he said something that I've never forgotten. He said, sometimes a thing and the opposite of a thing are true at the same time. Now we're back to Keats and Shakespeare and negative. How can you understand that and tolerate that when we want to be, particularly in an age where information is breaking over our heads like a tsunami and we want to silo everything? Please tell me this is good, this is bad, this is great, this is not, you know, so that we can categorize for convenience, for commerce, for whatever we do. And things just don't fit that way. You know, we made a big film on country music and people just want to say, oh, country music, that belongs right here. And you go, no, there are no borders. And, you know, the African-American influence on the birth of country music is extraordinary. And the African-American influence continued. And people listened to African-American music and African-Americans listened. When Ray Charles, arguably one of the greatest soul singers ever, had creative control of an album for a first time, in 1962, he made Modern Sounds in Country in Western Europe. It is a soul singer singing country songs, Hank Williams songs, others. The number one hit that summer was Don Gibson's I Can't Stop Loving You by Ray Charles. And if you listen to it, it is a soul singer, but it's a country song. And so it just explodes all of the stuff we want to go, no, 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 please fit into this narrow bandwidth so I can understand you and go, whew, that's over with. And you can't do that with anything. And I love that. It's subversive. It rebels against all of the tyrannies of the internet, you know, because it's neither and both. It's the opposite, a thing and the opposite of a thing are true at the same time.
So to continue along with that, Ben and I have long believed, I mean, really part of the reason why we started this podcast is that there's a good, a bad, and an ugly to American history.
Of course.
And our job is not to agree with it all or to love it all, but somehow we need to hold it all within ourselves and find some kind of reconciliation and acceptance of it. Look where we're at right now. And this is essentially what we've been talking about for the past half hour. But, you know, we think about the Civil War, the incredible documentary you made about the Civil War and what's happening now with monuments and the ideas of how to think about the Confederacy and how to think about the war itself. And of course, we see it in every aspect of our culture and our lives. How should we look to these uglier moments in American history with understanding and acceptance? How can we do that?
It's the human. We have to do that. We have no choice. If you think we have labored for too long in our schools and elsewhere with a kind of sanitized Madison Avenue view of American history, and it's just not that. But you then don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The exceptionalism, which we almost singularly claim for ourselves, doesn't look so great these days, but it's had lots of problems in various times. And sometimes it's the recognition of that. We were speaking about it before we started, is that the pursuit of happiness is like a red herring, right? When Thomas Jefferson wrote it, and it was agreed that the pursuit of happiness, meaning you don't get it, you try for it, right? It's always an objective that you have. And happiness was not the acquisition of objects in a marketplace of things. It was lifelong learning in a marketplace of ideas. That's what the founders meant by happiness. But we've kind of polluted, well, I deserve to be happy. You know, we have two kinds of freedom, right? My freedom, what I want, and the collective freedom, what we need. You know, we have laws, right? You can't drive on the left side of the road, right? You got to drive on the right side of the road. You've got to register that car. You've got to do all sorts of little things in which we all willingly submit, but find out some other area and nobody wants to do anything. This is impinging on my freedom. So we've had great tensions over all of that. And we've tended to ignore, it is very human to do this. It isn't just American. We have tended to ignore the things, the violence that takes place. That is part of our nature. The wars almost immediately become sentimentalized with treacly stuff, and we forget the extraordinary cost. You know, only mothers really remember what the cost of war is. And it becomes incumbent upon us, as we have done in the Civil War or World War II in a film that came out in 2007 called The War, or in Vietnam War that came out in 2017. We're now working on the American Revolution, to don't soft pedal it. You know, the Civil War wasn't a civil war. It was a sectional war, right? With the exception of Missouri and parts of Kansas, there's not a lot of civilian deaths, which is what happens in civil wars. It's a sectional war. This group believes this. This group doesn't believe this. We're leaving. No, you're not. This is the Civil War. You know, the siege of Atlanta killed less than 20 civilians. The civilian casualties in the greatest battle in the Western Hemisphere, if you just limit it to the land mass of North America and South America, is Gettysburg. And there are two civilian deaths, two, right? But the American Revolution, now that's a civil war. We always say brother against brother, you know, maybe. But in the Revolution, Benjamin Franklin's son, William, was the royal governor of New Jersey, was deposed, continued to work against the independence, was put in jail, was released, presumed that he would go to England, stayed, started a terrorist organization that killed what we would call patriots, and tried to reconcile afterwards with his dad, who said, NFW, right? And it's pretty shocking on both the son's part and the father's part. And it makes for a great, great story. But I think it goes back to the fact that we need to be able to have a complicated picture. We need to also be able to grow so that the whole manifestation of this monument stuff, I'm happy to grow. I'm happy to understand those monuments got put up, most of them, in the period after the collapse of Reconstruction. They were part of the expression, the billboards of the reimposition of white supremacy, of Jim Crow, of lynching as a legitimate expression of justice, of the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. The flag, the Confederate flag, was not the Confederate flag. It is a battle flag of the Army of the Northern Virginia, which was adopted by the Ku Klux Klan, one of many. It is not the official flag of the Confederacy. That's a different flag. It went into the state flags of all the Confederacy. It's come out now of all of them, including finally, thank God, Mississippi, which was the oldest. But when you look about when it went in there, it was, you know, the statues went up either in that post-Reconstruction period or in reaction to Brown versus Board of Education, right? A lot of those Dixie, the Confederate battle flag that went into the state flags of the Southern states came in after 1954. And the only thing that happened in 1954 is the Supreme Court said that separate but equal isn't right, as Plessy versus Ferguson in 1898 said it was. And so you've got, you know what? And people say they're taking away my history. It's not. You're actually pulling the lens back and you're having a much more inclusive history. And how can you take South Carolina, where the majority of citizens were African Americans, right? You know, the Mississippi, the same thing. I mean, how are we suddenly, if we're the land of the free and we have 4 million people owned by other people, oops, you know, this is February. This is Black History Month, and it's the shortest and the coldest month. Black history is every single day, because if you start a country and the guy who articulates our creed, distilling a century of Enlightenment thinking into one sentence that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal," and he owns more than 200 human beings, oops. He doesn't see the contradiction. He doesn't see the hypocrisy. And more importantly, doesn't see fit to free any of those people in his lifetime. And he sets in motion an American narrative that is a priori forced, as it had been since 1619, you know, to deal with it. But that's deal with it. I mean, right now we have three viruses going on, right? Three viruses. One is this year plus old COVID-19 virus. Devastating. Devastating. Once in a century thing. We also have a 402-year-old virus of white supremacy, of racial injustice, of racism, of hatred, based because it's easier to find evil in the other and to judge people based, as Dr. King said, on the color of their skin, not the content of their character. Now I've flipped his statement. And then we've got an age-old human virus that's around us, which is the virus of lying, of misinformation, of conspiracy, of paranoia. This is not American. This is everybody. And when those three viruses come together the way we are now, it is a recipe for disaster. And the only thing that sets us free is A, being honest about it, and B, telling us that none of these things are without some kind of precedent, even though the times are unprecedented. And that's our job, your job and my job, is just to tell a very complex and important history that delivers us to this moment. And you go, well, if history doesn't repeat itself, if we're not condemned to repeat what we don't remember, what is it about? So you go back to Ecclesiastes, right? That's the Old Testament. And it says, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun, which means that human nature doesn't change, and that it superimposes itself over the seemingly random chaos of events. And so we see patterns, we see motifs, we see recurrences of behaviors. We hear the rhymes, and that's what we're obligated to talk about. And nothing's off the table. Nothing's off the table.
You point out this what I think is beautiful, the way you said it, this idea that it's the pursuit of happiness and it's not the guarantee of happiness.
No.
And when you perceive it like that, though, if you read it as the guarantee of happiness, then any suffering is therefore you being denied something that you think you owe. But suffering is something that's universal.
And suffering's universal, and we're none of us are getting out of this alive. So there's the ultimate approaching suffering that people like Hemingway are going to try to deal with or not deal with, as the case may be. And our lives are more defined by the troubles that we've had. My mother died when I was 11 years old of cancer after a many-year illness. I would not be here if she had not died. I spent my entire professional life, as my late father-in-law, a psychologist, said, waking the dead. He said, you make Abraham Lincoln and Jackie Robinson come alive. Who do you think you're really trying to wake up? Now, that may be dime store psychology. It's simplified, but it has been the motivating aspect of my life. There's never been a day since April 28th, 1965, when my mother died, that I haven't thought about her and thought about the thing and missed her, you know, missed her. And so it's all there. You know, it's that that's who we are. I interrupted you, Ben, but I just think that we're defined by the way we handle the tough stuff. When it's smooth sailing, it's smooth sailing. We can enjoy running down the dock and jumping into the lake with abandon, but it's often when something comes up short. And every one of us, the three of us, and anyone listening to us knows exactly what I'm talking about.
You didn't interrupt me. You actually answered the next part that I was going to ask, which was, you know, and when you find people who have that idea that they deserve to be happy and they look for the cause of their suffering because they don't understand that it's a part of life, then they can't see the dark in the past. You know, and you've pointed out all of these things that, you know, I tell my students that saying you love the country if you don't know its past is like saying you're in love with a woman when you've only seen her online dating profile.
Right.
You don't know her. True love comes when you realize the dark and you know that you're better than that and you can make each other better. And yeah. So I was going to, my question was going to be was how do you find, when you acknowledge the dark, how do you find meaning in that and value in that and still say that you love even though you acknowledge the dark? And you already answered that question. So thank you.
Yeah, no, you have to. Winton calls that impending death, the kind of wolf at the door. And if you think about it, if human beings were really fully conscious of the fact that we don't get out of this alive, it's very reasonable to assume that you could be, you know, lying on the floor, you know, in the fetal position, right? But we don't. We raise children. We plant gardens. We make films. We write symphonies. We do things that offer the only corrective there is, which is to somehow bring meaning here. And that means you have to, with regard to our business, synthesize all of these different impulses, not just good and bad, but all of the myriad shades of gray in between, and negotiate something that commends you to this lifetime and to the people that you leave behind, right? And so, you know, my mother's name was Lila, L-Y-L-A, a 19th century spelling of it. Her mother had been named Lila. And for many, many years, the word Lila was draped in black crepe, right? We never said it. We said mommy, you know, even as adults, as older men, my brother and I said mommy. Because, of course, she left when you know, we were 11 and 10. And in 2011, my oldest daughter, having never met her grandmother, named her first child Lila. And now we say it all the time, and birds sing, and flowers bloom, and she's 10 years old, and it is a glorious, glorious thing. And so that, in my own little tiny way, is such a huge part. It's an anecdote to you. It's maybe a boring diversion to anyone else. I cannot begin to tell you how central it was. I was on a Zoom call yesterday and Lila came in and was like, oops. And her mom said, no, come in. And I'm going, hi, sweetie, it's Granddaddy. And, you know, there she is, Lila. Didn't say that. Didn't that meant that was never spoken for decades.
I'm not tearing up. I've just got allergies. That's all.
You just ticked off about seven projects that you're currently working on.
Yeah.
I have two questions here. The first one is, I have to know, did the American Revolution Project, was it born out of the Ben Franklin Project, or was it the opposite?
It's neither. I'll tell you. So I did the Civil War. When the Civil War was done, I looked and I said, I'm not doing another war. I mean, I know we'll pass through wars and we'll treat them, you know, for 5 minutes, World War One or whatever, but I'm not doing another war. It's just, it's hard. You know, the soldiers, Southern as well as Northern, when they'd been in combat, the description was they'd seen the elephant. And my only assumption is that they were trying to think of the most exotic, non-normal thing. And so combat was like seeing the elephant. And for those of us trying to take those gruesome old photographs and make a story of it, we'd seen the elephant. It was too much. But at the end of the 90s, I learned that something ridiculous, some huge portion of graduating high school seniors, you know, diploma in hand, going out in the world, thought we fought with the Germans against the Russians in the Second World War, and that 1,000 veterans of the Second World War were dying each day in America. Now, that number is way down because actuarially it's so little. And I said, we got to do World War II. So we started, you know, 1999 to work on World War II, and it came out in 2007. Before it was done, before I'd locked it, I just turned to Lynn Novak, my producing and directing partner, and I just said, we're doing Vietnam. You know, we're not ignoring Korea, but we're doing Vietnam. That's the toughest one to do. And so we worked, you know, from the end of 2006 to 2017 to do it. Well before that was done, while I was looking at maps of the Yadrang Valley and trying to figure out the extent to which these complex computer graphic maps could make things come alive without reenactments, which I don't like, I said, we need to do the American Revolution. I didn't know that knowing about the revolution would be hugely critical in the upcoming decades. So by 2015, I had already committed in my heart to the American Revolution, and it'll be the hardest project we've ever done. Meanwhile, on a parallel track, I'm a huge admirer and friend of the historian Walter Isaacson, who's written many wonderful books, two of which are Benjamin Franklin and Leonardo da Vinci, both of which are irresistible. And in fact, da Vinci, we shouldn't say ever say da Vinci, that's like saying, you know, of Walpole, that would be my name because I live in Walpole, New Hampshire. So Leonardo is that, it'll be our first non-American topic, and what a protean figure to do it. But it's the exception that will continue to prove the rule, because if I were given 1,000 years to live, and Bob and Ben, I will not. I would never run out of topics in American history.
You clearly don't do it all yourself.
No. Thank you for saying that.
So let's talk about how many crews do you have that are working on these projects simultaneously?
So right now there are four different producing teams in which I'm the director. And in one other case, I am the co-director. That's not true. Two other cases, I'm the co-director with Lynn Novick, and another case where it's Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein and I are doing it. But there are other projects, and my daughter Sarah and her husband David McMahon, they are also co-directors. We're working on Muhammad Ali. That will be out next after Hemingway, and they are doing with me the Leonardo da Vinci film. And the Emancipation to Exodus film mostly about Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction America. There's another crew working on the Buffalo. There's a kind of hybrid crew that is Benjamin Franklin, but will add to do Revolution because there's economies of scale. But this is only recognized long after both projects were underway, that it was good to have the same people looking for pictures, paintings, drawings, maps for Franklin would be a big help to the Revolution team that's going to come later. So the Revolution of Franklin will come out in probably in 2022, and the Revolution will come out in 25, which the 250th anniversary of Lexington and Concord.
In my classes, needless to say,
God willing. I mean, I wake up at 3 a.m. I woke up this morning at 3:30 and I went, and it was just revolution. Like, oh my God, you know?
Needless to say, I was pretty excited about this interview, and I mentioned it in one of my classes that I'm teaching here from the home studio atop a building in Brooklyn. But what I said to my students was, I'm interviewing Ken Burns, and most of them knew you, right? And I said, but we've got a lot of audio and video majors there. And what I said was, so you guys have heard of the Ken Burns effect, right? And a couple of my students who are doing video editing were like, yeah, of course. And they at first didn't know your name right off the bat. And then they were like, oh yeah. And this is something that this will be there.
It's the technological tail wagging the dog. I'll tell you what happened is that I had the great privilege of being friends with Steve Jobs, who is an amazing human being. And I stayed with him and his wife and kids when I stayed in the Valley two or three times over several years, even when he was getting sick. But when the first time we met, he called me up and he said, here in New Hampshire, and he said, can you come and meet me? And I said, that's me knocking at the door. So I fly out to Cupertino, California, and I go inside, and he's got these two very eager, classic, nerdy engineer developers. And he said, we loved your Civil War thing. We've been working on, and all your stuff, and we've been working on this thing that allows people to pan and zoom in their photographs, right? Now, I am the world's biggest Luddite. And I kind of go, uh-huh. And they show it to me, and it kind of is working. It's a prototype. It's not even beta, right? And it kind of works, and I kind of get it. And it says you can upload. And I go, well, I have no idea what upload means. Or you can download, whatever it is, you can do this with your stuff. And I said, well, that's great, not really knowing what I was doing. And he said, yeah, so we'd like to keep our working title. And I said, what is it? And he goes, we call it the Ken Burns effect. And I said, I don't do commercial endorsements. And he goes, what? You know? So he dismissed the guys, and we go back into his office, and we talk for about an hour, and I tried to explain who I was. And there's a lot of people who've said, oh, you should have asked for, you know, a tenth of a penny for every time it was used. I said, then he would have called it the pan and zoom effect. I said, you just don't understand this person. And I didn't realize that now, but I said, no. And he said, well, what can we do? And then I said, maybe I don't want to get paid, but what if you gave me a lot of in-kind, hard-earned software that I can give to nonprofits? And I think a couple of computers fell off the truck in advance that went to our office because we were so, you know, impoverished of that kind of stuff. But we gave a lot of, you know, Final Cut Pro to colleges, and we gave a lot of hardware to various nonprofits, and that gave me a kind of plausible deniability. But I now know my kids use it all the time. My younger kids use it all the time, but I now know how many bar mitzvahs and vacations and weddings and whatever it is I've saved because of the relentless. It is a thin, superficial, nothing pejorative about that version of what we're trying to do, which is wake up an old photograph. Trust that photograph is a representation of a now, and that horse and buggy are passing through that scene, that car is whizzing by, the train is going by, the troops are tramping, the cannon are firing, the ice in the bar, in the glass in the bar in the jazz club is tinkling. All of those things we try to listen to as well as see, and treat an old photograph the way a feature film maker would a master shot, having a long, a medium, a close, an extra close, a tilt, a pan, a reveal, zooming out, and inserts of details, you know, whatever it might be. And that's what we do. That's how we re-photograph the photographs. And it's an attempt to wake it up. It's an attempt to say, we trust you to be a representation of a very full and vivid present. And it is the great arrogance of this moment that thinks that we're somehow better than previous moments because we've survived. People lived as complicated lives as you and I are living. They don't know how to reboot a computer, but you don't know how to shoe a horse. Right? Yeah, but the depth of conversation, the complexity of love, the dimensions of suffering have been around for as long as there have been human beings. And we kid ourselves, and we kid ourselves all the time that somehow we're better because we know more than our grandparents, you know? you know, we have an expression now, being woke. Every generation has had an expression of being woke, including our grandparents' generation, you know? So it's just, you know.
It's great that you quoted Ecclesiastes, because we have these right now. We are all, you're in New Hampshire, Ben's in Tennessee, I'm in North Carolina, but we're here like we're in the same room.
Ben's in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Ben's in Brooklyn. That's right. Brooklyn, Tennessee. But the technology changes, and you could say it advances. It surely has in many ways, but the human heart has not changed.
Not changed. And you can hear people talk about when the telegraph came in, oh, this is the death of letters. Oh, this is going to kill human communication. Nobody's going to write a book anymore. Nobody's going to read a book anymore. I mean, it's just plus ça change, you know, and this is what it is. So people say, wow, what do you do now? And you go, you just use the tools you have. Is it an email? Sure. Okay. It's an email. Is it a newspaper? Yeah, still newspapers, you know, is it online? Maybe. Whatever it is, you're just going to, the stuff that we collect in order to tell the stories of the past is just stuff. It's the question is how you tell that story that Ben brought up at the beginning. You know, how do you include all that stuff?
So you have a body of work now that is educating old and young. Talk about Project Unum for a minute before we wrap up.
Unum, you know, that comes from my love of that late historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said in the late 80s, we suffer today from too much pluribus and not enough unum. You know, there's not a person on earth or in this country that doesn't agree. And for those who don't know, e pluribus unum is the Latin motto of the United States, which means out of many, one. And we are very much missing the one right now. And so Unum was started several years ago, supported by the philanthropist David Rubenstein. And it's an attempt to curate those evergreen themes that appear, the rhymes of American history, that as Mark Twain would say, and that we would be able to deal with stories and connect them to the present in a way we don't ever do in our films. But to see that all of the films, indeed all of American history, is a very complicated warp and woof. That's the expression of weaving, right? Of threads going one way and threads going the other. And we have many intersections in our film, and we just feel it was important so that when Charlottesville happened 4 years ago or 3.5 years ago, we brought out in Unum one of the last comments in the Civil War series, you know, in which Barbara Fields, a distinguished Columbia University scholar, says, you know, if people are living on the street and some people are living in homes, the Civil War is still going on. It's still going on and regrettably can still be lost, because there you have, in Charlottesville, Virginia, a hugely important center, Thomas Jefferson's home, where the first, you know, secular university is founded, a temple to the Enlightenment, are people, you know, that are espousing Nazi and racist views that are antithetical to a huge majority of American citizens, and were condoned by the president of the United States, who said there are good people on both sides. There weren't. There are aspects of those people that are good. Maybe they don't beat their dogs or their wives, but these are abhorrent views. And we need to remind people of what the American story has been. It's not saying that these views have never been there. And that's why you begin to see how evergreen Barbara Fields' comment is, and so many others. This past summer, after George Floyd, we trotted out several comments that the late writer James Baldwin said in our film on the Statue of Liberty, one of which he recites the second sentence, and when he gets to "All men are created equal," he says, "Obviously that proclamation did not include me." But almost no one ever asked themselves, "What is liberty? What is liberty?" And then later on he says, "It's a bitter joke, meaning nothing to black people. In fact, that statue faces outward, supposedly welcoming," but that's been in huge debate ever since too. We're making a film on the United States in the Holocaust right now. And, you know, it's a war between Emma Lazarus' poem, "Let's Open the Door," and between another poem by a white supremacist who said, "Close it. Let's keep all these other filthy people out of here. Let's keep it American." And this has been a tension that you know, continues to this day with the policies of the Trump administration and Stephen Miller, that we're trying to figure out how we find an American way through that represents consensus and represents the right thing to do. And how do we support the moral, the implied moral underpinnings of our government when we failed throughout? We have never included African Americans in any significant way. And when we do, it's a kind of phony tokenism that has been in every aspect of life, that we're three white males here. And, you know, we'd have no idea and need to shut up and listen more what it is to be redlined in housing for generations, what it is to be paid less or to have a lesser job or to not be promoted or to not be able to get in to someplace despite your jobs. And if you are getting in, being accused of it being some sort of you know, corrupt devil's bargain of affirmative action. It's just we only this pandemic has shown us that it's risky to go to the convenience store. We never knew that until now, but there's not an African American that doesn't know that it's risky to go to the convenience store. It's risky to jog in a neighborhood. It's risky to be driving down the road and have your taillight out. I've been stopped by the police for speeding. I've been stopped by the police for not signaling a turn. I've been stopped. Nothing ever happened to me. There are a lot of people who turn up dead because of the color of their skin for just those things. And that's what Barbara Fields means. And until that's addressed, you know, we're only hoping to be what Lincoln said we could be, which is the last best hope of Earth. That was his State of the Union, or what was called Message to Congress in those days, as the Constitution requires, in December of 62. You know, fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. But then he also says, he can't escape history, but he said, the dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. As our case is new, let us think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves. Don't make yourself a slave to ideas, and then we can save our union. What he went on to say was the last best hope of Earth. That's the business I'm in, holding our feet to the fire of that promise.
Well, Ken Burns, Ben and I know enough to know the quote to end an interview on.
It's always good to end on Lincoln, isn't it?
Thank you so much. This is amazing.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you for your work.
So grateful for your time. We will continue to look to you and your work as we can, as we enter this and move through this fourth great crisis
in our nation's history. We'll get through if we remember the unum and not the pluribus, right? We're all in this together. What I understood is that I have, for more than 40 years, been making films about the U.S., but I have also been making films about us, the lowercase, two-letter, plural pronoun, and also we and our, all the intimacy of that, all the majesty, all the complexity, all the contradictions, all the controversy of the United States of America. But the one thing I've learned is that there's only us, know them. There's no them. There's only us. And if people can live that, then you've already gone a long way to, as Lincoln said, disenthralling yourself, making you less of a slave to the ideas that limit us and keep us down and keep us from communicating with one another as equals.
That was a fascinating conversation with Ken Burns from the podcast The Road to Now, hosted by Dr. Benjamin Sawyer and Bob Crawford. Go search for and find The Road to Now wherever you get your podcasts.